starts out like that. I think back to page one. All right. We'll go back manually.
Now we all know the same.
We'll just kind of rush through it here. All right, let's hope it stays there this time. There we go. Okay. So, yeah, as we already said, basically this is an extension of the previous talk, which is a very nice introduction. And I'm trying to really tailor the BKL conjecture so we can apply it in loop quantum cosmology. This is work I've done with Dave Sloan and Abhi. There we go. So just a brief introduction. I'm the first one here to mention loop quantum cosmology. So I have to actually skip the page, don't we? There we go. So I'll just mention these things briefly. One of the main themes of this work.
I think you should not have a remote control because it's
Oh, so it's doing the automatic thing. Yeah, this is. All right. Well, let's just cancel that program entirely and use Adobe. Technical problems. Yeah. Yes. Alright. There we are. Where's the full screen? Where's this on here? What was that?
Command L.
Command L? Okay. There we go. Thank you. All right. So now we got through that. I forgot the preview does that. It's just automatically for you. Okay. So we know in loop quantum cosmology, at least in the homogeneous and isotropic models, we have a prediction that the Big Bang singularity is resolved and replaced by a quantum bounce. And so there's the immediate question as to whether this is some kind of artifact of the symmetry we've assumed, especially because this was not derived from full loop quantum gravity. This is kind of an application of the same techniques, or whether this will be a feature of the full theory. And so, of course, we want to look at more general models. For instance, Bianchi models and Gaudi models, which will both be talked about during this workshop. And even better, we'd like some sort of simplified model akin to a symmetry reduction that encompasses a large class of singularities, specifically cosmological singularities. And so as we just heard, there's growing numerical and analytical evidence that a general cosmological singularity is described by the BKL conjecture. So for just a brief review, the BKL conjecture is that spatial derivative terms in the equations of motion become negligible as we approach near the singularity. Also, that most types of matter become negligible. And basically, the result of these two is that the dynamics near the singularity is mixed master. As you heard, it's a sequence of Bianchi 1 solutions separated by Bianchi 2 solutions. Or in some cases, we just have a final Bianchi 1 solution, which would be these asymptotically velocity-dominated cases. And so we can apply this conjecture to obtain what we'll call a truncated theory, where we neglect certain spatial derivative terms to obtain a theory that basically gives the dynamics near the singularity. And the idea is that if we have this theory that's valid near the singularity, we can quantize that resulting theory, and that may give us at least a more general notion of singularity resolution. And so this is akin to doing kind of a symmetry reduction, but instead we're kind of doing this kind of a BKL reduction. And so basically the goal of this work is to describe this conjecture as well as this truncated theory in variables that are well suited for quantization. So we kind of have to adapt the BKL conjecture so we can actually apply it to the to loop quantum cosmology. So that's really the goal of this talk. So just for a brief outline, we'll introduce some variables and some motivation for these variables, as well as motivation for our truncation we're using. What is this truncation? Really, kind of what would we call the BKL conjecture in this case? A little bit about the dynamics of that, and then just a brief conclusion. So first, just preliminaries. We'll be working in the phase space of the densitized triads and their contact momentum KAI. We'll take this triad to be invertible. And we're working this mostly for, clarity of presentation. In the end, you can do the canonical transformation to return to the real connection. So they have a simple Poisson bracket. Also here introduce this gamma, which is a connection compatible with the triad, just defined by this. This gamma is some complicated function of the triad and its inverses and derivatives. And so this will become an important variable as we progress. And so in this form, we have three constraints. We have the scalar, vector, and Gauss constraints. Fairly common form. This D here is the metric compatible derivative, which will ignore the internal indices. Q is the determinant of the spatial metric, and R is the scalar curvature associated with this metric compatible derivative. And so, we'll continue along. So here we'll really motivate what truncation we'll be using. So the main question is, what derivatives exactly are negligible? One technique is to, initially, as we heard, is to really discard all derivatives. And the resulting theory will be Kasner, Bianchi 1. In that case, you can take solutions and plug those back into the full equations of motion and see what terms remain and do this kind of a consistent potential approach. Unfortunately, that doesn't work out very naturally for going to the quantum theory. So we're instead motivated by the scale invariant approach of Ugla et al. As was mentioned, this is one of the two current approaches for trying to do the fully inhomogeneous fully inhomogeneous spacetimes. So their idea is, we can divide all our variables by the trace of the extrinsic curvature. Basically, divide it by proper power such that the remaining variables are scale invariant. So if we rescale a metric, these variables will now just remain the same. And what happens here is this extrinsic curvature is diverging typically at a singularity. And so that divergence will suppress divergences in other variables. For instance, the triad itself will typically diverge. But by dividing by this trace K, this quantity will become degenerate for a typical singularity. And so it's actually this term here, this triad over K, that will suppress spatial derivatives in our equations of motion. Well, at least in their form, they'll express their derivatives and equations of motion and constraints. And so, roughly, what the conjecture is for them is that it's a triad over trace K contracted with partials of just some variables Y, which would be functions or quantities with internal indices, also divided by trace K, that these terms will go to zero as we approach the singularity. And so this has been supported by numerical simulations of Garfinkel, which were mentioned. This is done in the for spacetimes with no symmetries, and the evolutions were in vacuum. And so you see both that these terms here, the triad over K, go to zero, as well as the suppression of these derivatives. And also, the simulations kind of show that if you take the full equations and get rid of all these derivative terms, those resulting equations actually do line up very well with the actual simulations. And so there's a problem here right away is, we see that these inverses, like 1 over K, is very difficult for the quantum theory. We'd much prefer things, like products and sums of our phase space variables. And so we want to just take this as a motivation, but kind of move away from it somewhat. And we notice, fortunately, that our densitized triad actually has very similar properties to this triad over trace K. The important one is that this becomes degenerate at the singularity, mostly since this root Q, the volume form, is going to zero. And so, actually, for simple solutions like Bianchi 1, actually this root Q and 1 over K have the exact same time dependence. They both go as T. So they're really suppressing the triad in the same way. And so we'll take our negligible derivatives to then be of the form this triad contracted with, in this case, the metric compatible derivative of some densitized functions or densitized objects with internal indices.
So the important thing is that this quantity is not so much that triad is degenerate, but it's regular. It does not go.
Right.
It also happens to be degenerate, but more importantly is that regular.
Yeah, well, it's a nice feature that the other variables are regular, but it is important to actually that this triad does suppress derivatives. So it's important that it is becoming degenerate. That way the derivative terms can remain large, but the triad is basically pushing to zero. So we'll introduce two variables here, and these will use us to talk. Basically, we're constructing objects that are just densities with internal indices only. So basically, they're formed from the contraction of the triad with K and the triad with this triad compatible connection gamma. And this form is chosen just kind of with hindsight, ends up being simpler. And this, you'll notice, is similar to the ADM momentum, PAB, because this is basically K minus trace K QAB, roughly. And the same form for these variables C. Also, for kind of a shorthand, introduce this derivative, DI, to be the triad contracted with the metric compatible derivative. And so these will be the objects that will be negligible as we approach singularity. And so, yes, it's important that, it's interesting that these, PIJ and CIJ are densities with internal indices only. And so they'll become kind of an interesting feature later on. And kind of surprisingly, the constraints and equations of motion for P and C can be written in terms of PC, this derivative, and the lapse only. So we can write all three constraints in terms of just these quantities P, C, and these derivatives. And the equations of motion for P and C are written in terms of just these four. So this will kind of motivate what our conjecture will be. And just a little note here, we've modified the vector constraint by contracting it with an initial triad. But since this triad is invertible, it has the exact same constraint surface and will have the same solutions. So our form of the BKL conjecture is exactly that the derivatives of the quantities P, C, and the lapse will go to zero sufficiently fast as we approach singularity. So basically, these three derivative terms will go to zero faster than terms polynomial in these variables P and C. And this is similar to the conjecture that's put forth in the work of Ugle et al., where they would have had it's the triad divided by K, contracted derivatives of some very similar quantities, but instead of being densitized, they're divided by K as well. And so this also implies kind of a surprise that this quantity C becomes symmetric as the singularity is approached. And so, two, we expect that this PC as well as lapse remain bounded as the singularity is approached. And actually, this is more restriction on lapse, requiring that the singularity is basically pushed off to infinity. And really, the result of these first two is that the solutions to the full equations of motion are well approximated near the singularity by solutions to truncated equations where these derivative terms are set exactly to zero. So this is really what we'll take to be our BKL conjecture. I mentioned we can obtain our truncated theory by setting these derivative terms exactly to zero in the equations of motion constraints, as well as making this quantity C symmetric. And so this forms a subspace of the full space, which is invariant under the full dynamics. So if we have these four quantities zero and evolve with the full Hamiltonian, they'll remain zero. So this is really a fixed subspace of the full evolution. It's another interesting feature that this truncation reduces the full Poisson brackets to this very simple form between P and C, which typically the Poisson brackets between P and C really wouldn't close in terms of P and C alone, but here they do. Just P and C is just a sum of two terms of C the Poisson brackets of two of these p variables is just p again. And these p's really are here forming the algebra of like GL3R. And then it's kind of like these c's are really transforming as a symmetric representation of GL3R. So it's kind of an interesting Lie algebra here as well. So actually applying this truncation, so we set these derivative terms to zero and the constraints, they have this very simple form. An important feature is that these constraints are in terms of this quantity C and P only. So they depend only on these densities with internal indices. So the scalar constraint is just very simple. It's basically Cij, Cij minus 1/2 the trace squared. And it's symmetric between in C and P. So this symmetry is only broken by the Poisson brackets. The vector constraint is here a sum of a term proportional to the Gauss constraint plus a term that says that P and C commute as matrices. And then we just have the same Gauss constraint remains.
So when you say only C and P, what else would it be?
It could have depended on the triad and... But that'd be the other variable we have, really. And so a similar thing occurs to the equations of motion. If we take the full equations of motion and set the derivative terms to zero there, we obtain these three. So you notice that the evolution for C and P is independent of the triad. So C dot depends on only these variables C, P, and the elapse, as well as P dot depends on only C. So we end up with a closed system in terms of just these variables C and P. So really, they're independent of the triad, we can evolve C and P independently and afterwards evolve the triad. So we can just solve for these and then just kind of evolve the triad as kind of an afterthought. So we have an evolution which is closed in terms of these variables C and P. So we'll really take that to be, we'll take these to be the variables that really define our truncated BKL theory. And so we can check consistency here and see that we can generate these equations in two ways. In one, we can take the full equations of motion and set the derivative terms to zero there. And two, we can just take the Poisson brackets we introduced above here, take Poisson brackets with our the Hamiltonian, which is constructed from our constraints, and that gives the same equation. So basically what we have here is our truncation, or getting rid of derivatives, commutes with the act of taking Poisson brackets. So then also the constraint algebra will be unchanged for the same reason. So we can further simplify this by fixing the Gauss and vector constraint. As I mentioned, the Gauss constraint just requires that P is symmetric, and C is already symmetric by our conjecture. And so the vector constraint then requires that the two commute. So we have two symmetric computing matrices, so they're simultaneously diagonalizable. And it turns out that diagonalizing P and C actually gauge fixes both the Gauss and vector constraint, which is kind of surprising that this is gauge fixing the vector constraint here. So we reduce to just 6 degrees of freedom, the 3 diagonals of C, the 3 diagonals of P, with an even simpler symplectic structure. The Poisson brackets of P with P's of P's and C's of C's are 0, and the only non-zero Poisson brackets are between these P's and C's, which is, just gives a C. So applying this gauge fixing, we now just have one constraint being our Hamiltonian constraint. It's a very simple form. It's the sum of the squares of C's minus... It's the sum of the C's squared minus the sum of their squares. And the same form for these P variables. And fairly deceptively simple evolution equations, I would say. You can be solved in some cases, but in general, you really can't... They're quite complicated to solve. So this is really the resulting theory we have. We've gone from the full theory, and by setting these derivative terms to zero and then gauge fixing, we're left with this one Hamiltonian constraint, with these evolution equations, and these simple Poisson brackets. So this is really the theory that we would then want to quantize. And so just to briefly discuss the actual evolution here, we've analyzed these equations numerically and analytically. This is an example of one numerical evolution. The top graph here are the three diagonals of C, and the bottom are the three diagonals of P. Basically, what we see is exactly this mix-master behavior, where we have the three diagonals of P constant is exactly a Kasner or Bianchi 1 solution. So we have three regions here, this is the start of a fourth. And where these diagonals of C then just grow quickly and shrink is exactly a Bianchi 2 solution, or these tau transitions. And so you can see that basically the first diagonal of C grows, the first diagonal of P changes value, and same for the second diagonal of C, second diagonal of P. So we have here four Bianchi 2 transitions. And so we can also see the U map directly from these evolutions or drive it analytically from our equations of motion. And so we do see that after this reduction, we do get back to the expected evolution that we would see in these numerical simulations. So conclusion, we're able to describe a bit fast probably, but we're able to describe the BKL conjecture in a Hamiltonian formulation with variables that are suitable for quantization. And so second, we have this consistent truncation of the full theory obtained by setting these derivative terms to zero. And third, and importantly, this theory reproduces the expected mixed-master behavior. And so the next step would be to actually try to quantize this theory. And there's many ways to go about this. One, we could just do a standard quantization, in which case our Poisson brackets form a simple Lie algebra. So it may be quite possible to pass to the quantum theory in a more traditional way fairly easily. For doing a more loop quantization, there's a problem in the fact that the constraints are written in terms of these P's and C's, or equivalently in terms of the triad contracted with the real connection, and either C, which is a function of gamma, or P, which is a function of K. So this is a similar problem that shows up in the full theory, where the scalar constraint depends on this term. So it's kind of a place where we can test the regularization of those terms. Otherwise, we can also try to really represent this term as well in terms of harmonies and fluxes. So we kind of have a choice of which form you want this constraint to be in. It's kind of a nice testing ground for seeing how to regularize that the product constraint containing these terms in the full theory as well. So there's some initial ideas of how to do this in terms of harmonies and fluxes. And there's also the possible intermediate step of really looking at the effective equations in this model. This is kind of what was done for Bianchi 1 initially. We know kind of what the quantum corrections should be coming from. At least we've learned the quantum corrections would be in the homogeneous and isotropic models. So we can use those same corrections in these equations to kind of get a sense of what the effective evolution would be. And so that's kind of a possible step between, the classical and actually doing the full quantization. And so that's all. And if anyone has any ideas about how to handle these terms, that would be wonderful. So, all right, thank you. I think probably first looking at the quantization of the gauge fix theory. So if at first it is made much easier to analyze classical dynamics with this gauge fix theory, but also for quantization, it'd be much nicer to deal with the simplified theory than to deal with the full theory and having free constraints. But it'd be interesting just to also to look at quantization in both cases, just to do kind of a check of the Dirac program and see if we can actually quantize in the full case of all the constraints and do some sort of gauge fixing afterwards and see if we get the same results as this gauge fix theory. So.
You don't have any reason for believing that to be true at this point.
No. So. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If we just have curvature, just go. So, I wonder if we have some phenomenological, say, scalar field, surface or matter rulers.
Okay.
We have something like gradient phi. And that, in principle, should be able to be expressed in terms of loop variables. Just like, so, say, for example, value across a certain edge, then if we can have something like gradient phi contracted with k, then that will be, that might be expressed in terms of the whole, just like that edge.
Okay.
And while at the same time, maybe we can see the gradient phi contracted with k will have the property of scaling variance in the classical theory. I wonder if that's my help.
Yeah, that could be.
That particular test would not arise in any simple coupling. K contracted gradient class does not arise in any realistic scale of use of potential like that. You would not get that. But there would be the term that you would get would be ease contracted gradient class. And this simplified model, the idea is that this spatial density. I mean, what this does is to make it decide what you mean by the statement that the spatial derivative is a mainly is the densitized trias E tilde contracted with the spatial derivative on physically interesting fields are negligible compared to time derivatives. So, if you have a scalar field, what would survive in the truncated equations would be really only time derivatives of the scalar field. That's what will happen. Any other questions? I think to me it was extremely non-trivial that there is another formulation for the scale conjecture, because normally it is formulated in terms of this ADM variables, and you want scale varying variables, finding trajectories, stretching curvature, and so on. Those were unfortunately not useful for quantization. So it was not obvious that one could have a formulation which is all kind of self-consistent from the decay point of view and yet amenable to quantization. So it was not a priori that there was not a big reason to believe that in fact you would get the IQ1 behavior, the IQ2 transitions, and the spikes, everything that one sees in the normal framework, that one would also get. Consider these rescale variables. That you have got a rescale system of rescale variables which is closed in the Hamiltonian domain, which doesn't happen in the Hamiltonian domain. And that you reproduce all the things that you know about in the EKMDN. The two things are equivalent to each other, only if in fact the trace of the extrinsic curvature has certain behavior. Basically, the trace of the extrinsic curvature multiplied by the square root of the determinant of the spatial metric had non-zero limit as you approach the singularity.
Well, that was going to be my next question. So they're not, in fact, precisely the same conjecture, but you understand exactly the conditions under which they are.
Right.
So there might actually be, would it simplify Rubin theorems in terms of controlling the special cases?
Yeah, it might, because there are some simplifications in this. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked at the special, some of the exceptional cases that make the mathematical analysis difficult?
We have not found any. The cases that one, if you look at BIQ1 and BIQ2, simple cases of them, the two are equivalent to each other. So I think first we have to find something where the two are not equivalent to each other, then see if it is equivalent. So that's an open question.
Yeah.
Can you repeat what was the condition?
Can everybody speak here? You can just switch on the mic.
Yeah. So which one of these?
This is the determinant of the metric. Yeah. Like trace of extrinsic curvature. So this behaves, the Yankee one model, this behaves like time. This behaves. at some point in time, they will be manifested. So if this has a non-zero effect, it should have well-defined effect, and should not be no with zero. The minimum exists. Thank you.